Hey, and we are live with another version of the MMA prospectus, or as we've just been told, should be prospective. Apparently, a prospectus is a financial document used to give people an initial look at an investment. So why we would use that to talk about prospective, fighters and athletes who the UFC might be looking to invest in, or fans might be looking to invest in, I have no idea. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't connect. It's not a one-to-one relationship that we should even try to build at this point.
Yeah, it's just crazy how, you can take a word and then kind of extend its meaning to talk about conceptually related terms. It's crazy. We're crazy. Zane, what are we doing here? What are we
I
doing?
know what at this point we might as well just scrap the show and start over from something else entirely.
Exactly.
We've been told.
Yeah, we're bad. We'll try to do better. That's all we can promise.
For those of you who are tuning in, you may have noticed, if you're tuning in regularly, you may have noticed by now that Tom is not with us this week. He's currently on a cross-country road trip to join the secret Metamoris Kumite that he heard about. The news just broke today, and he took time off work, jumped in his car, said goodbye to the wife and the dog, and he's off to see if he can, he'll hook some fools and get on to the biggest show in the world. For people who like to grapple other people in their pajamas.
Yeah, just grappling fools for gas money all the way from Chicago to LA. So we hope he doesn't get caught in any truck stops. We hope he doesn't run into any Sylvester Stallone types from Over the Top.
Yeah.
We're really looking out for his health. We wish him all the best in that quest.
Yeah, I agree. The Sylvester Stallone over the top image was the first thing that came to mind for me as well, because I don't know if any of you have seen Tom, but he's basically a dead giveaway lookalike for Sylvester Stallone. So I think, he's maybe got a big rig going on kind of thing, and that's really like picture that. That's Tom, and that's all you need to know why he's not here right now.
Yeah, it's a good look for him. I'd say I think we're both pretty stoked for this new direction he's taking.
Absolutely. It's something that I think will really show a lot in his future development as a history teacher and whatever else it is. Or no, wait, I can't remember what he does. I don't even know anymore. One of those things. These are people, like, you people only exist as fiction to me, so
Except for Tim Burke, whom you've met in person. He's a natural
Tim Burke
person.
I've met. I have partied with Tim in very brief spells. He once brought a case of Heineken to my house. He hasn't been back since.
There's some poetry in there.
Yeah. So we're here to talk about UFC Fight Night, Henderson versus Thatch, performances from the prospects on that show. We got a few guys to look at. Obviously, Brandon Thatch, Ray Borg, Chaz Skelly, James Muntasri, and then we're also going to talk a bit about the upcoming card, Bigfoot versus Mir. There are a few interesting guys, Thiago Trator, notably, and Rustam Khabilov. And then, if we branch off anywhere in between there, we'll be doing that too. We were hoping to talk about sort of maybe how the UFC's PED policies might affect rising prospects in the sport, but I think we're going to save that for when Tom's around because that was really more his thing. So first up, what was your, who impressed you the most off UFC Fight Night, Henderson versus Thatch? What was your big performance that you looked at and were like, oh man, that was just beautiful?
See, I'm going to go a slightly different direction with that and say Kevin Lee, because even though the performance was not super sharp, it was exactly what he needed to do. And a guy like at some point, every prospect is going to have to beat a guy like Michel Prezeres, a guy who's like just a huge, powerful wrestler and grinder who has no illusions about what their game actually is, who's just going to do their best for 3 rounds to take you down, land some hard combinations at close range, and then grind you from top position. Everybody's got to beat a guy like that at some point, especially at lightweight. Lightweight has a bunch of those dudes, and that's a test that Lee passed with flying colors. If you have good enough wrestling to do that, then you have good enough wrestling to compete at the very highest levels of those divisions. And so from that perspective and kind of the meta sense, in terms of what their performance meant, I'm going to have to say Lee. What's your pick, Zane?
Yeah, actually, that's really good. I mean, Lee performed beyond my expectations, because I did expect Prezeris to be too much too soon for him, and that as young as he is in his career, I thought that somebody as consistently developed as Prezeris would actually beat him. And, you know, I think Prezeris did, like, test his striking, but the fact that Lee is such a well-developed wrestler and counter-wrestler at this point in his career, it really just stunted Prezeris' fight, and that says great things for Lee and his development. I mean, that's one of those skills that you absolutely must have to compete and win consistently and get to the top 15.
It's also worth noting, at lightweight really does not have a lot of dominating wrestlers compared to other divisions. Like at welterweight is absolutely stacked, probably because there's an NCAA wrestling class at 174 pounds, and a lot of guys can cut the extra four to make it down to welterweight when you've got a long fight camp. But welterweight is just absolutely stocked with really big, powerful wrestlers. Lightweight, not so much. We're starting to get more of them now, mostly in the form of guys coming over from Dagestan, like Khabib and Khabilov. But yeah. But really, there's no former NCAA wrestlers in the top 15 at lightweight, are there?
Not with Henderson gone. There's not. Henderson, was he actually even NCAA? I don't even know that he was.
An AIA wrestler.
Okay, so yeah, I don't think there was. That's a good point. I think the big thing there is at lightweight, there's a lot of at lightweight to supplement that, is that there are a lot of huge Brazilian grinders who will chew you up if your wrestling isn't on point. They may not be like the NCAA sort of technical cream of the crop when it comes to their wrestling game, but guys like Prezeris, guys like Buscape, Adriano Martins, Francisco Trinaldo, Gleison Tebow, there are just a bunch of guys like that that will absolutely just hulk you around if you're not prepared to fight off that kind of attack. And so for Lee, getting past even one of those guys, that's already a big point in his favor.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I will say this, and I'm curious to get your perspective on this, Zane, because I'm not super sold on the striking of guys coming out of Extreme Couture. Like, it's not bad, but it's not great. It for whatever reason, and I think Brad Tavares is maybe the most salient case of this, but, like, you know, it's fine. It works, but it's not especially high volume. It's not especially powerful. You get a lot of circling at range. The output can kind of drop below acceptable levels. But they all have. I mean, it's punch kick combinations. It looks right, but just it's worth less than the sum of its parts. Almost. I don't really know how to describe it.
Yeah. It's true. I guess the thing is that I described is just like rote, workmanlike. I just like it exists, and it's you know. I mean, and that's fine. I mean, if you look at other camps, I'd say like maybe not. It'd be like saying ATT's wrestling, you know. Like I think about how well ATT guys wrestle, and they're fine at it. They do it well. But I don't think of that camp and then think, like, oh, man, there's just a bunch of guys who have, like, a really technical, good, consistent wrestling game or something like that. I mean, I think it's just one of those things that, yeah, like, they don't do it badly. It's certainly done a great job of getting Lee out of that funky style he was trying.
Yeah, he was trying, like, a Philly shell, like, shoulder roll kind of style that is really, really weird. And yeah. Like, he wasn't very good at it, more importantly. Like if you're good at it, that's okay, but, like, the style itself offers so many disadvantages that you have to be really good at it to make it work. I don't think we've ever seen it really work in MMA.
No, the closest would be, like, Mark Hunt.
Yeah.
He's kind of the only guy. And, you know, because he can do, like, the hands low, parry low, and roll around punches kind of thing. But, like, you know, and that's at heavyweight, where you really are not fearing almost anyone diving in on your legs for a takedown. You know, there are like five or six fighters in that division that are just going to take you down.
Yeah, and especially in Hunt's case, because his center of gravity is so low, like, it's easy for him to get his hips out of the way. But, yeah, I mean, Lee was impressive. Lee looked really good. You know, his offensive wrestling is glorious, and his top game is really, really freaking good. Like, that one takedown he hit, I think, in the third round, just the drive on that was insane. Like, dude is a specimen.
Yeah, he's definitely putting the right tools together. I think the other performance I was impressed by, honestly, was Chaz Skelly. I mean, you know, and that's to say that his striking maybe didn't look great. He throws a lot of lead uppercuts, which against more developed strikers is going to be a severe danger. But it was still, you know, he still won the fight there. And for a guy like him, that's kind of huge. Like, that in and of itself, because we know he's working with Ludwig now for his striking. He's going there for his striking training. And so, I mean, getting a win like this may be the kind of confidence booster that gets him focusing more on how to do it better, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he's his game gets progressively less impressive the further out you get. So on the ground, he's awesome. In the clinch, he's good. In kind of wrestling exchanges, he's solid. Then you get all the way out to range, and you're like, it's a little rough. It's a little rough around the edges and maybe all the way to the middle. But it's getting better, and that's what you want to see. It doesn't have to be one of those things where you show up and you look like and you look terrible one day and you're Anderson Silva the next. You just have to consistently get better as you move up. No, go ahead.
I was saying, a big part of getting better, I mean, like, it's functionally, it's just, like, that willingness to trust that you can fight there consistently. Like, that's a huge part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, like, where do you think Skelly's upside can take him? Like, how high do you think he can go in the featherweight division?
I would put him functionally at about the Nick Lentz level, like, top out, top 10 borderline, where that, you know, I mean, he's already kind of, like, got the Darren Elkins style, like, solid. Like, that's exactly what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And he's young enough in his career that I think... How early is he, actually? Let me...
He's coming into a year, so...
I mean, I think, like, you know, maybe he's got another couple of years to develop. So I think he can push that envelope into that, like, you know, he'll maybe move up to, like, 7 at some point and before kind of dropping back down. I mean, I don't know that I see him being a title contender just because, I can't see him ever being so technical on his feet. He would be, I mean, you look at the top 5 of that division, and it's all guys who strike with a lot of craft.
Yeah,
you know, and... what's his name? Who just beat? Fought Jose Aldo recently. Throws a bunch of spinning stuff.
Ricardo Lamas.
Ricardo Lamas, yeah, that's a bunch of guys with great striking craft, and Ricardo Lamas. I mean,
and even Lamas may not be like a super dynamic striker, but he's more than competent. He is a plus striker from a technical perspective relative to that division. And in Skelly's case, I think the thing that limits him, and it's not going to limit him yet, but the problem is he's not super explosive, and if you can just consistently maintain distance on him, then you're going to be able to beat him. Because he's not a guy who has a super explosive shot to get in on you. He likes to chain wrestle. He likes to grind and control in the clinch. And if you can create space, if you're a guy who can just stay away from him, you're probably going to be able to beat him. And Aller's had some success when he was able to create distance and stay away. It was when he got tied up that he really got himself into trouble. I'm not sure, like, I mean, Skelly's huge. He's really long. He's got crazy leverage because his limbs are so long. Like, if you're tied up with him, you are going to end up in trouble at some point or another.
Yeah, but I think, and that brings me to something I want to talk about it here, is that, like, Aller's is at the point that shouldn't have been as big a problem as it was.
Yeah.
And it's troubling to see how poorly he handled this fight, because he's getting to the point where he should kind of be like a finished product. Like, he should be a guy who's hitting a roll, everything's clicking, he's, you know, winning fights, and it looks like his striking stopped developing like 2 or 3 years ago. You know, like he's just not improving. His defense was really bad, and his offense was maybe a little better here and there, but not to the point. I mean, he lost a striking battle to Chaz Skelly. Like, that's the end deal, and that's not good.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Aller's case, like, he's a poster child for the limits of working at smaller camps for pretty much the entirety of your career. And that's not a knock on Aller's. It's not a knock on his coaches. I think they really, in the grand scheme of things, he's really done a pretty good job in terms of building his skill sets from one fight to the next. But you reach a point where you've just got to get more work in with really, really, really top guys. It stops being optional. And so, like, I'll give you a parallel for this, and tell me what you think of this comparison. But Rick Story. Rick Story went as far as he could training at a small camp. Actually, a lot of similarities between he and Aller's in terms of their games. Both big, physically imposing, strong guys, wrestle-grappler types. And Story's striking kind of stopped developing. Then he went to TriStar for a couple of camps. Then he started going down to the lab. And he kind of got over that hump. And I think if Aller's went to ATT or went to the Black Zillions or, you know, I mean, he lives in South Florida. Like, those are options for him. Yeah. I think if he did that, we might see really, really rapid improvement, kind of a backlog of stuff and things that he'd been working on kind of fall into place.
Yeah, it could be, because he certainly has the physical tools. He's really strong, powerful, very good grappler, very good wrestler. Even has some natural movement on his feet. Like, he's not, like, just totally clunky and awkward. But it just seems like the technical tools have not been developed beyond, like, throw 1-2, chase down, throw 1-2, chase down. Like, that's where his striking's at. And something has to change to get over that.
Yeah, I mean, in the featherweight division of like 3 or 4 years ago, that combination of skills would probably take him to the fringes of the top 10. The way that featherweight looks right now, that's, you're barely a top 25 fighter looking like that. And you know, he's a talented dude. He could do it. But like at some point, you really do have to start asking questions. And I think you're right about that, Zane.
Yeah, so we got a couple of expectably strong performances from a couple of guys that we've been following and have been high on for a while, out of Ray Borg and James Muntasri. Borg was especially dominant in a fight that he should have been dominant. His striking hasn't really come along any further, but he's such an athletic freak that it doesn't have to yet.
Yeah, he has yet to hit the wall where it's like, okay, this is a thing that you have to do, or you're just not going to beat these guys anymore. And, you know, I kind of wonder over the long term whether that might actually hold him back a little bit, that he's such a dominant wrestle grappler that, like, and he's so able to close distance because of his athleticism that, like, it doesn't seem like as pressing a problem as it really is over the long term.
It could. It'll depend on how fast he gets fast tracked. I mean, it could, like, because the long term for him in this division could be the short term. Yeah. Like, if they're like, hey, fight John Dodson, then wow, you know, suddenly he's got a problem.
Yeah.
But if he fights, you know, I know Mookie was suggesting, like, have him fight Chico Camus and then Chris Carriasso, mm-hmm. and to, like, build slowly. If he does that, then yeah, he could very easily survive for a while without really highly developing his striking, you know, without really putting a lot more time into his striking game. Because, yeah, it's just this is one of those fights, like, it's a good cage time, stay busy win for him, but it doesn't really tell you a lot more about him as a young fighter, and he's still very much a young fighter.
Yeah, and Borg's another dude who, again, at some point, is going to have to get to a bigger training camp. There's nothing wrong with, you know, I feel like it's important to emphasize this repeatedly, but it's like, it's not like you're going to be a shitty fighter by dint of the fact that you're working with smaller gyms and less high and fewer high-level training partners. It's that you're never going to be as good as you can be if you're not doing those things. Like, I could point you to any mass of data that you want to look at, and it's going to prove that just over and over and over again. I mean, like, the body of evidence is too large to be denied. But, you know, with that said, for now, Borg looks really good. And his game flows together in really logical and compelling ways. It's worth every one of his skill sets. I mean, he's like the prototypical, like, new breed MMA fighter where his skill sets individually are not that awesome. It's the way that he puts them together that makes them so incredibly compelling and makes him a really good fighter.
Yeah, and I mean, having the athleticism to put them all together at the speed he does, which, like, I mean, at some point, like, you don't have to be amazing at everything when you're doing it at, like, five times the speed as your opponent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, at the end of the day, Chris Calades is probably a more knowledgeable fighter and maybe a more skilled fighter than Ray Borg is. But when your opponent is a freak next-level athlete and you're probably slightly below average for the division, it's like they have a cheat code where they get to pass go and collect $200 every time, and you're stuck on and you know you're stuck in fucking jail, I guess. I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, let's step away from the metaphorical side of this. If we were good at metaphors, we wouldn't have named our show Prospectus. I mean, obviously, right?
True.
And that gets us to the other guy who showed up and put an expected beating on his opponent, James Muntasri, over Cody Pfister. And first of all, Cody Pfister is not long for this world.
He's really not very good.
But I think in that sense, I'm a little troubled with Muntasri because I really want to like him. He's one of those fighters that I look at his skills, I look at how powerfully he strikes, and like the collection of talents, and I really want that to be a great fighter. But he doesn't do enough of the basics at all to make me comfortable with that right now. Like, he's got the athleticism and he's got the explosiveness. He's both explosive and athletic. But it's a question too, because, like, you know, he took his first fight in 2008, but he really only started training and fighting consistently in 2011, so he's probably got, you know, more than a few years left to round out his game, but he definitely needs to focus more on the basics, it feels like.
Yeah, he's an interesting case. I think we've talked before about the kind of spectrum between being a super process-oriented fighter and a super dynamic fighter, you know, like where Anthony Pettis is at one end of the spectrum and George St. Pierre is at the other, where the difference between trying to finish a fight in these very particular moments and just trying to win every single minute of every single round of every single fight that you're in. And a guy like Muntasri, if he's not at the absolute dynamic end of that spectrum, he's pretty close to it because his process is almost non-existent. Like, he's hitting you with big shots, he's hitting big takedowns, he's hunting for submissions. Like, if he doesn't get those, he's gonna lose the fight. Like, he burns through energy really fast because his style is super explosive and he's a super explosive guy. Like, if he doesn't finish you inside about 7 minutes, he's either gonna get finished late or he's gonna lose a decision. Probably. Yeah. That's the most likely outcome. And, you know, you're right. He does, if he wants to make the jump, especially in a division like lightweight, that's just full of dudes who may not set the world on fire, but they're just not going to lose rounds, but they're durable and they're process-oriented and they're just not going to lose rounds. They're just not going to lose 2 of 3 to a guy who's just constantly throwing spinning shit and huge punches and what have you. Like, Gleison Tibau is not going to lose to James Muntasri, you know?
No, like, or even, you know, Norman Park, like, mm-hmm. you know, he's one of those, like, those are the kind of fighters that are lightweights full of. They're just big, solid guys who, they may not be, like, explosive enough to put you away, but they'll just grind you down over 15 minutes and do so without breaking a sweat.
Yep. That's their game. They'll do that, and then they'll be ready to fight on short notice again 4 weeks later, just like Gleison Tibau.
Yeah.
It's like that division, because it's so deep, and this is true of welterweight too, because those divisions are really deep, because they've got a ton of guys in them, like you get these subclasses of dudes who all fit this profile to a greater or lesser extent. And because it drives the evolution of the sport. When you have that many guys doing that many things over a large enough sample, you get these really clear patterns of development. And the process-oriented, big, powerful wrestler is just a thing at welterweight and lightweight and, to a lesser extent, featherweight. It just exists, and you've got to have the kind of game that can get past them. Anthony Pettis is just dynamic enough that he can. He can do that against anyone. Any fighter at any fighter at 145, 155, maybe even 170. Like, Jimmy, I don't think he's that dude. But he's still going to be hellaciously fun. And maybe he does get
that. Yeah, I'll say this. I think he's just a little bit more on the technical side of the Pink Panther. Who's that? Yozdenis Cedeño. Like, he's just slightly more on the process side of Yozdenis Cedeño, mm-hmm. who was, like, zero process whatsoever.
Yeah, and, like, Muntasri reminds me of... You've seen Palaszewski Pettis, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, which was a robbery, and Pettis should have won that. Like, it was a shitty decision. But, like... Muntasri against Pfister and against Ellenberger just reminded me so much of, like, young Anthony Pettis, like, doesn't give a fuck, is just gonna throw spinning shit with no setup all the time because he just feels like he's that much better than you and that much more confident. And Pettis learned from those decision losses and became less like that. He became more fundamentally sound, more process-oriented, still incredibly dynamic, but just he cut out the stupid shit. And Muntasri has lost two decisions doing exactly that kind of stuff and hasn't adjusted at all. So it puts kind of a limit on it, don't you think?
Yeah, and we'll see. I mean, it's all like time is the great factor in projection. You know, it's just one of those things where like it does, but 4 years from now, who knows? Like, mm-hmm. you know, I think the baseline thing is that at least he has the athleticism to show that kind of thing, because that's something that he could never gain. Like, that's not something that he could pick up later. He's not going to become more athletic. Yeah. So
he's an absolute freak physically. Like, he is ridiculously fast and strong and powerful.
So it'll be interesting. He's a guy to watch, but it's definitely a case of, like, watch to see where, you know, what comes out of it. Those are the big things. I mean, the other thing, obviously, is Brandon Thatch. This is sort of his, like, first bid for glory, and he almost came out. I was impressed by it. I thought he did great. I can't believe that anyone is less impressed by it. You know, I expected him to win, but he came really close, like, really close to winning.
Yeah, the fact that he was on Henderson's technical level for most of that fight. That's the part that's really compelling to me. Like that Henderson, Thatch came out early in the fight, and Henderson was able to time his rhythm. You know, like Henderson figured out the patterns in Thatch's movement, and Henderson for the first probably 4 minutes or so, every time Thatch was ready to throw, Henderson could see it and timed it and broke Thatch's rhythm, and really messed with it in interesting ways. Thatch adjusted in the second round, and there were points in the second round where he was just beating the crap out of Benson and landing big shots and really had him in trouble. You know, the difference between the former lightweight champion of the world and a guy who was in his 13th pro fight is that Benson then adjusted again and added another layer to it and exploited a weakness on the ground. But no, I don't understand how you could walk away from this fight and think that Thatch is really anything less than advertised. Like, he got beaten by a drastically more experienced dude with with a way deeper skill set. Like, that happens. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, too, where it's also like, and we've talked about this before, it's just sort of one of the big differences with the UFC is just how tough people are. And, you know, especially somebody who rises to championship level in this sport, like, those guys are, by and large, not going away quickly if they, if you're in a fight with them. And that, I think this was just one of those things where, like, he'd never fought somebody like that. He'd never fought somebody where not only did he need to hurt them, but once he'd hurt them, he needed to stay on them and keep hurting them consistently for another 3 or 4 minutes to ensure that that finished the job. You know, it was like giving him time to check his hair and giving him time to, and like hugging him and all that. And it's just like, no, you're able to throw this man to the ground and punch his head through the canvas at any time. You can't then get it, like, give him a chance to get back in the fight. So, you know, hopefully I think it was a learning experience in that kind of way of, like, at a certain level. You know, it's his first introduction to fighting at that level, and I think that was probably just a harsh wake-up.
Yeah, I mean, and Benson is one of the most insanely durable dudes in the history of the sport. Like, even when he got flying kneed and punched, like, square 4 times in the jaw, he wasn't out. Like,
yeah.
And there were, you remember how pissed people were about that stoppage? Like, there were a lot of people crying bloody murder over the fact that they stopped that. That's Benson's only knockout loss, was after he got flying kneed and blasted in the face by the new look Dos Anjos. Like, so the fact that Thatch wasn't able to put him away, that doesn't, like, reflect poorly on him. He's going to be fine. The only thing he has to do, he has to get back in there relatively quickly. He needs to get back in there within the next 3 or 4 months. He can't do another one of these, like, 8, 9, 12-month layoffs and expect to maintain any sort of momentum.
Yeah, that's very true. Is there anybody else you want to talk about off that card? I feel like, I don't know, that should cover it as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think we're good. We can move on to this week's card.
All right. So we're looking at this week's card, and there are a lot of interesting fights that I'm kind of interested in. Mm-hmm. But I'll admit, like, there aren't a lot of huge prospect fights where I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to see how this guy develops. Like, I feel like there are a lot of guys who have already developed and developed early, and we're just kind of seeing them now as fun fighters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sean Strickland is a good example. That guy had 5.5 years of professional experience before he even debuted in the UFC.
I don't know how much more we're going to see of Sean Strickland, like how much improvement we'll see of him from him beyond where he already is. Like, I think he'll fight really well for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, but will that be, like, Every time out, we're going to see a whole new version of him? I don't know, like, yeah, it's kind of... And that also gets to the weird thing of, like, I'm still not sure about guys who start when they're, like, 15 or 16. Like, I don't know enough about how that progression looks. I think I do, but only through very small glimpses, you know?
Well, the sample that we have to work with, because... For our viewers / listeners, in case you don't know, Sean Strickland is a Southern California dude. He started fighting professionally when he was 16. I think he had amateur fights at 14 and 15 before that too. And we don't have a big sample of those guys. We don't know what that looks like really. I mean, you know, off the top of my head, you've got Jordan Meehan, Rory McDonald, Caro Parisian, Jose Aldo started fighting when he was 17. Miguel Torres was like 17 when he started. I think Manny Gamburian too may have been 16 or 17 when he had his first fight.
Yeah. So we've got like a few people, and most of them flame out by 30. I'll say that.
Yeah.
Is it most of them tend to flame out by the time they're 30. But when we kind of work off this baseline idea of 9 years, and that's where the trouble for me is like, do I really expect somebody to flame out by 25?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And I don't know about that.
Yeah, that's really hard. And because there are data points to go both ways, right? Like, you can look at Caro Parisian, who, for a variety of reasons, was basically done as a top fighter by the time he was 24, 23 mm-hmm. or 24. Then you look at somebody like Rory McDonald, who's consistently getting better now at, what is he, like 26?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and Rory
Mac...
doesn't
seem anywhere close to falling off.
Yeah, like Rory Mac looks fine. Jose Aldo is now 27, coming up on 28, and Aldo's been fighting for 11 years as a pro. Looks pretty good, all things considered. Doesn't look like he's dropping off. But then you come across dudes like Glaristone Santos, who's a Brazilian dude, fights out of Brazilian top team, who started fighting when he was 16 or 17 and is now 26, and you're like, oh yeah, that dude's a completely finished product. He's not getting any better. In fact, maybe he looks a little slower this fight than he did his last fight. And you think, like, oh, yeah, maybe that dude really is dropping off at age 26 or something.
I still don't know that I expect... Like, I don't expect Aldo to have a long career after 30.
Like, I think you and I probably would both say that, like, he's probably done... Unless he's, like, absolute GOAT material. Right, unless he's the absolute greatest of all time, he's probably done as a champion by age 30.
Yeah, I would kind of assume, especially just with the division evolving under him. Like, he's already, I actually looked at this the other day, and I would actually argue that he, more than any other fighter, has already more convincingly beat the former generation, the current generation, and the future generation of title contenders. Like, I mean, and that's just with his last win
Mendez
again. Like, if he beats McGregor, that would be ridiculous. Like, you know, we're talking about somebody who beat Uriah Faber and Mike Brown, and back and Cub Swanson back when they were the old guard. Mm-hmm. And has then beat, the Ricardo Lamases and the Mark Hominicks and the Chan Sung Jungs and all the title challengers who were, like, right developing at the same time he was coming into his own. Mm-hmm. And now we're starting to see him take on, like, he beat Chaz Mendez young, but he now beat Chad Mendez in his prime with, like, a much better version of that. And he now beat... he beat Ricardo Lamas, and, now if he beats Conor McGregor, it's just sort of like you're beating all the guys that are coming up after you've well established your name. Beyond the point that I think even, George St. Pierre, like, Hendricks was really kind of his first, like, this is the young up-and-comer that's developed underneath you mm-hmm. come up and challenge for the belt. And then he stepped away.
Yeah, and you could see really clearly in that matchup. And this is clear too. Stephen Wright is a good dude. I've spent a lot of time talking to him in various capacities. And like Stephen Wright was saying, for like 2 years before that fight, they were working wrinkles into Johnny's game with an eye towards beating George St. Pierre. And Chad Mendez had been working wrinkles into his game for years to try and beat Jose Aldo. When you beat the guys who have been working for years with a target on your back to try and beat you, that's something totally special, and you don't see it very often. I mean, like, off the top of my head, like, who can you think of as guys who beat multiple generations of fighters? Like, George St. Pierre beat the generation before him, and he beat his generation, which were two totally stacked generations of welterweights. But
Anderson Silva, he obviously beat like Rich Franklin and Chris Lieben and some of the guys that were good before, and then he beat Talos Latus and Damian Maya. And then I guess if you consider like Yushin Okami and some of the guys that he beat right at the end to be the new generation, maybe. But even still, he ended up facing like Chael Sonnen and Vitor Belfort, like guys that had very definitely already established themselves sort of during his reign.
Yeah, and Fedor, and the guys that Fedor beat were essentially of his generation. I mean, yeah. I think we'll probably see it with Jon Jones. So it's like Jon Jones and all of the basically fall into that category.
Jon Jones is actually definitely doing that as well. I think Gus and now Anthony Johnson is maybe his first real, like, this is somebody who's coming into his own well after you've established yourself. Because he definitely beat all the former guard and all of his current challengers. Like, that has happened. And actually, Cormier, I would say. Cormier and now Johnson are kind of like the guys who are coming to prominence well after he's established himself as a dominant champ.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely true. I mean, and the way that you know is something we touched on this a little bit, is like when guys are reacting to your game, when guys are building themselves to beat you and they still can't do it, from the beginning of their careers, when they're building themselves to beat you and they still can't touch you, that's I think that's like the next that's the next level. And I mean, at the end of the day, too, GSP did get his hand raised against Hendricks, so you know,
even if you don't think he won, that fight was so close that it's still like a miraculous fight for GSP, especially at the sort of decline. Like, he obviously had lost a step, and he was still like tooth and nail, punch for punch in there with Hendricks until the final bell.
Yep. That's one of those fights, like, I wish people would go back and watch it fresh to get the meme out of their head that, like, oh, Hendricks got robbed. Because he didn't. It was, I thought it was like a 50-50 fight, and challenger bias was in such great effect that just because Hendricks wasn't losing, clearly, people automatically thought that he was winning. I don't know. At any rate, kind of got off track here. Sean Strickland. I like his game a lot, and I could see him getting substantially better if he did a better job of staying, like as his understanding of range gets a little bit better. Like, his striking game is very counter-oriented, which is probably a thing that's going to extend his career, in all honesty, because he doesn't get hit very much. But what he's got to do a little better job of is staying a little bit closer, like a half a step closer would give him probably, like, I would say probably a 20% increase in his volume, in his output, if he were just a little bit closer and a little sharper. And I think that would make a huge difference. Like, I think instead of winning kind of close decisions, I think he would be knocking dudes out.
Yeah, I mean, you want to see more of... You want to see your counter-strikers, your very good counter-strikers. You want more Rashid Magomedov, less Tyron Woodley. Like... You know, and right now he's very much in the Tyron Woodley mold of, like, I'm going to hang way back, and then if you keep getting, like, if I find an opportunity so obviously and wide open over and over again, I'll take it. But it has to be, like, handed to me on a platter.
Yeah, which is not an uncommon thing for counter-strikers. Like, you can see that process get better over time. Like Rashid Magomedov is a really good example of this. Like, his first fight in the UFC, he was a little tentative, and you can see it too when he was in M1. He was a little tentative, the volume wasn't quite there. In his last few fights, though, he's really picked it up. And so there's precedent that if you're high on Sean Strickland, I think dropping a weight class will help him too, because it's not about the size, it's about the length, that he's almost always now going to have a reach advantage. And that's going to extend his effective range where he can hurt his opponent. So
it's interesting. It's an interesting move, and I'll be interested to see how it plays out, especially with the weight cut. I don't know, because he just seemed like such a big fighter that if that weight cut is troublesome for him, then I could see it being a really bad move really quickly.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. No disagreement. I mean, so here's a question for you. What do you think of Santiago Ponzinibbio?
I feel like I like him less than I should. Like, I think he's a very surprisingly functional takedown and ground and pound fighter. And then he's a powerful enough brawler to get away with the fact that he's not a very good striker. Like, he's so powerful that the fact that he's technically just kind of wild and all over the place doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, and that's very much my read on him, because he's a specimen physically.
Yeah.
He's huge, he's strong, he's really powerful, he's really fast too. But But yeah, no, he relies too much on that. Oh, also, he's got incredible killer instinct. I think he's got some of the best killer instinct I've seen. That, like, when a guy flashes and you can see, like, a dude's hurt, Ponza Nibio picks up on that and he's just on you. Like, if he hurts you, you're probably not getting away. But at the same time, he's really unpolished. Like, there's, like, he's still got a lot of work to do to get to the point where he's consistent enough to beat guys in that weight class. Like, because he'll kind of circle and circle, and then he'll throw two punches and a kick. And then he'll throw a kick. And then he'll throw two punches. And it's like, it's not enough volume to win decisions or to, like, drastically increase your chances of landing a power shot. Essentially, you're relying on somebody running into one of your big punches at the highest levels. Like, I'm saying, like, you've got to rely on somebody running into you instead of really creating your opportunities for you. Like,
yeah. And the difficult part of that is, of course, that he's been fighting long enough that he should be pretty much a finished product by now. So, I mean,
how long's he been in the game?
Since mid-2008.
Yeah, it's probably about time for him. It's now probably now or never. Like,
yeah.
If he doesn't make his move this year, he might never. But I'm actually really interested in that fight for both guys.
Yeah.
I'm like, because they're both the kind of dude who could take a leap, like, in any fight, and you're like, oh, wow, this guy's really good. Or they could kind of develop on kind of a slower curve, or they could just not get any better at all. You have no idea, you know?
So I want to ask you, since this is one of the fighters I'm actually interested in, I kind of like his game, but nobody else seems to care or know at all or have any interest in him at all, but Thiago Trator.
Yeah. He's an interesting fighter, right?
He's a really interesting fighter, and I think he's got a really bright future. Like, he looks like a great athlete, and he's got this just, like, grinding Muay Thai style. This sort of, like, get in your face, press you up against the cage, and then just chop you down with clinch work and inside Muay Thai.
Yeah, I was really pleasantly surprised when I watched him on film, and I thought, oh, you know, another random Brazilian dude with exactly the same skill sets as everybody else. And then I started, like, because when you watch a lot of regional MMA, the way that you and I do, and that Tom does, like, this is an archetype that we've seen conservatively 100 times. We've seen exactly this dude. So I wasn't really looking forward to it, and then I started breaking him down, and I thought, like, oh yeah, this guy's pretty good. He's a good functional wrestler. It's nothing too terribly technical, and, you know, it's not like he would be a Division I All-American or anything, but, like, he knows how to defend takedowns in a technical fashion. He knows how to get you to the ground in a technical fashion. He times his takedowns well. He's really strong on the inside. He's solid at range, if not awesome. But he's really strong on top. If he gets on top of you, you're not getting up. He'll keep you down. He'll blast you. He mixes his passes and his strikes really well. And he's super physical. Like, really big, really strong, really fast.
Yeah, so I'm really excited and interested to see how far he can go in the division. I mean, I think, you know, he's not quite... He's still, like, 5 years or somewhere around there, so he still has a little development and growth room to do. And I'm interested to see how well he can do that. And I think De La Torre is kind of the right fight for him just because he's somebody who is... like, athletic and does a lot of things, but is also at this point in his career very much a, like, finished fighter. Like, that's very, very not very likely to change up his approach highly. And it's no one part of his game is so, like, distinctly technical that I expect to see him take, you know, like, Trator will have to watch out for getting caught by something big, basically. And if he can avoid that, then it should be a good fight for him.
Yeah, De La Torre reminds me of, like, a more powerful version of Chris Camozzi, where he's, like, a volume kind of pressuring, but not really very good at pressuring. Like, he wants the pressure, but he'll kind of follow you. He doesn't really cut you off or force you to the cage. Like, he wants to put volume on you, but he's not super powerful. He's got some power, but he's not super powerful, which separates him from Camozzi, who is just the definition of pillow fisted. But, like, Yeah, I mean, he's not, but he's a tough challenge. You can't fall asleep at the wheel with him. You're going to have to fight for all three rounds, and he's a tough dude. And it really is. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's the perfect fight for a guy like Trotor, where he's at right now. It's the kind of fight that'll show us like what kind of upside Trotor really has. Because if he kind of bumbles around and wins a close decision, we're like, okay, probably need to dial back some expectations. But if he blows De La Torre out of the water, be like, maybe we've got kind of a diamond in the rough here.
Yeah, somebody who could at least like come close to the top 15, be one of those. And, who knows how far developed at that point. It's all, having some sort of technical striking game always sort of, like, that gets my eyes into, like, the sky's potentially the limit, depending on athletic ability and how well you can round out skills around that, because that's always sort of the hardest missing piece to develop when you get to, like, the top five,
Yep.
It's like wrestling will get you to the top 15 or the top 10, but then, like, that technical striking game is that missing piece that makes it really hard for guys to get beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely, because you've got to start doing it, you've got to start striking at that level when you're young enough that as you get older, you can pick up the nuances. You can pick up timing and rhythm and a variety of different footwork approaches. You've got to be able to do a lot of different things to be a high-level MMA striker. You've got to deal with a lot of different approaches and ranges and guys who are going to try and pressure you and guys who are going to try and fight in the middle of the cage. You've got to have, like, and just the sheer distances and timing are really hard to deal with in high-level MMA. So you've got to be there. You've got to have some skill as a striker by the time you're 4 or 5 years into your career, or you're just never going to be able to compete at that level.
Yeah, definitely. And so Trotor is somebody that I think we should definitely be watching out for. Beyond that, I feel like there are a lot of guys that I'm kind of like, maybe if somebody shows me something really excited, I'll get excited about you again.
William Vicario. McCarty.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. You said that, and I'm like, I know exactly who you're talking about. Because you see it with him, right? Like, you see exactly what we were just talking about. You see the physical tools. You see he's got great raw power. You see the kind of budding technical striking game with him. Like, he's got good timing. He's got good distance. He can put volume on you if you're not super elusive. Those are all things that he can do. The problem is kind of inconsistency. He doesn't have a ton of different tools. Like, he's got the kind of intangibles, but he doesn't have a lot of different ways of putting it on you. Like, yeah, so... But he should blast Matt Dwyer, right? Like,
yes. He should demolish Matt Dwyer. Dwyer, to this point, has not shown anything other than being big and tough, and not so tough that, like, he's going to survive. Like, there's one thing when you're, like, Cath Alpendred tough, and it's just like, oh my god, what is wrong with you? Do you, like,
Do you like getting hit in the face?
Like, how did you survive? Like, what factory made you to take punches? So that's one thing when you're that kind of tough. But as Albert Tumanoff was quick to point out, Dwyer is not that kind of tough.
Yep, double tap head kick, Albert Tumanoff.
Yeah,
like, just put Dwyer and Macario. It honestly, from where I'm sitting as an analyst, it would be a disappointment if Macario didn't finish him with it, or at least didn't finish him without putting a hellacious beating on him.
Yeah, it's definitely that kind of thing. So the other fight like that, there's also Wendell Oliveira, who, I mean, at this point is a finished vet, but like, I would like to be interested in him again, and that would definitely mean finishing TJ Waldberger. Like, he cannot struggle in that fight.
Yeah, if he loses to TJ Waldberger, it's like, okay, back to the regionals you go. And it's one of those fights where, like, the setup is so obvious, I feel like I'm missing something, because Waldberger has a terrible chin and Wendell Oliveira hits really hard, so he shouldn't just knock Waldberger out, right? Like,
yeah, especially because Waldberger's always willing to strike a little. He's always willing to get in there and mix it up on the feet just long enough to get hit really hard.
Like, against his better judgment, like, against all reason and logic, TJ Waldberger is a willing and game striker.
Yeah. And the thing is, I can see why, because, like, he's actually a pretty good athlete, and he actually has a little power himself. Like, he puts some... Yeah.
He's not a bad boxer.
No, but it's the Brendan Schaub thing, where it's like, just because you're not bad offensively does not mean that you're erasing a massive problem lurking right behind that.
Yeah. Like, it's almost amazing... How, because it's not just that Wahlberger's chin is bad, it's that he's also just terrible defensively. Like, every single possible thing that can go wrong with a fighter in terms of having bad defense, Wahlberger has that. Like, doesn't move his head off the center line, doesn't really take great angles, doesn't really control the distance very well. After he throws a combination, he has a tendency to kind of drop his hands and stop and admire his work. Like, literally, like, in a checklist of bad things that fighters do defensively, Wahlberger is all of those.
And that brings us at me actually to a good point, that Wahlberger is a great example of a fighter who started at, like, 15, 16.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He started fighting in 2005, and he's 26.
Wow. That's really bad, man.
Yeah. So, like, you know, we're looking at a dude in his mid-20s, who we're already thinking, like, he's, you know, like, he's not going to win this. Like, he's not developing. He's a known, very fallible product.
Yeah, I mean, so, because, even if he, like, let's assume that he wins this fight. His ceiling is obviously well outside, like, the top 40 of the division. Top 30, yeah. Top 40. Because there's, what, 90 welterweight signed right now?
It's about 86 right now.
Yeah, and I don't know that I would put him in the top half of that division. So even if he somehow wins this fight, he's still getting knocked out by probably 20 of the top 50 welterweights.
Yeah.
So that's not an awesome spot to be. But anyway, TJ Waldberger.
Anyway, this is a question too. And these guys are both sort of the edge of prospectdom, mm-hmm. which is Cody Gibson and Douglas Da Silva. And this is another one of those fights where I'm like, really, like, one of you guys has to show me something right now. And I expect it to be Cody Gibson, because neither of them train at a good camp at all, at a big camp, at a good, notable camp. But Gibson's base is a pretty scrappy, aggressive wrestling game, and Da Silva's is a homemade Muay Thai game. And I do not expect the homemade Muay Thai game to stand up.
Yeah, I mean, Douglas Silva is one of these dudes who defends takedowns almost purely. Like, he's an awesome athlete, and he relies on that really, really heavily to defend takedowns. So, and that failed him against Zubaira Tukhugov, who really has a pretty solid technical wrestling game. And he's not, like, an awesome wrestler, but he's a very, very good wrestler. Gibson, I think, is a better wrestler than Tukhugov is, and he's crafty with it. It's weird the way that he uses it, but he's very competent. He's highly competent. And so he should be able to kind of ground out Douglas Silva and do work on him. But, yeah, I mean, in Gibson's case, like, he was beating the crap out of Manny Gamburian before he walked himself right into a guillotine. That's probably not something that Douglas Silva is going to do, but... the concern is there, because it's not just the guillotine. It's like, this is not the first time Gibson has done something dumb and put himself in bad positions.
Google him, bitch.
Yeah, for those of our viewers who are not familiar with this, Cody Gibson got socked upside the head in a bar fight shortly after saying, Google me, bitch. Which was one of my top MMA moments of 2014.
I think it kind of got forgotten too quickly for my taste. I will always remember that and associate his name with every time a bro says he can beat up a UFC fighter, I will remember that moment.
Yep. That sounds about right.
Yeah. Yep. One of those sad moments for UFC fighters everywhere that...
you just get smacked upside the head by bar bro. And,
after yelling, Google me, bitch.
it's just outstanding. What an encapsulation of our humble sport.
Anyway, this brings me to the last, I think, prospect. I want to seal it. I keep forgetting how long Frankie Saenz has been around, because he's actually one of those fighters that is definitely better than advertised. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, actually, I'll say Frankie Saenz, too. I think Frankie Saenz is better than advertised. Mm-hmm. In that he's got a really well-developed takedown interior boxing game, especially to the point that he likes to dump fighters, wait till they, and then like hit them as they're getting up. Mm-hmm. You know, he really has this good. It's like Frankie Edgar Light game. Mm-hmm. You know,
he's a pressure fighter, and he's a pressure fighter who knows what he's doing. Despite not being the world's most experienced dude, like you pointed out, he has been around for a while, and it's clear that even if he hasn't been competing regularly, he's been in the gym. The skills are there. The skills are what you would expect from a guy who's been fighting regularly, even if the actual fights haven't shown up on his record. When we were talking about Mike Della Torre, that he was a pressure fighter who didn't really have the footwork to actually pressure. Mm-hmm. Saenz does have the footwork to pressure. He's not, like, nobody's going to confuse him with Matt Brown or somebody or somebody like that. But it's a good pressure game. His boxing is good enough. He uses his low kicks really well to cut off your angles if you try and circle out and plant your foot. Saenz is going to kick your leg. And he's not like a super technical kicker, but if you plant your leg and he kicks you, it's going to hurt enough to force you back the other direction towards the fence where he can really go to work. Alcantara should beat him. He just should, but it's an interesting fight, and Saenz is not a bad fighter at all.
No, it's one of those points, I think, where you get like, Alcantara, unfortunately, it's like a really quick meeting for Saenz with that idea that at some point athleticism will out. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think Alcantara is a more technical fighter anywhere, but he's a really ridiculous athlete.
I think Alcantara is probably a more technical grappler.
He might be a more technical grappler, but I mean, even still, like, so much of everything he does is based on how quickly he can explode into it and cinch things up.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think the only place where we would really see like a massive skill disparity is if Alcantara somehow got Saenz to the ground and got on top. Alcantara's top game is legit as hell. He was able to shut down Wilson Hayes when he got to top position. The problem is, you know, Saenz is a good wrestler, it probably won't get there, but still, Alcantara should win, but it's a more interesting fight than it's being given credit for.
It really is. Like, I was actually a little surprised at how heavy a favorite Alcantara. I mean, I wasn't surprised because it's a name value favorite. You know, the favorite's chosen by what they expect people to bet on, not what should come out. But it's a close fight. I mean, if Alcantara fades after the first round, it could be a very interesting fight for him. If he can't out-wrestle him early and he just starts to gas, then it could be problematic, because if it comes down to a clinch battle and inside boxing and all that and a lot of sneaky takedowns from Saenz, it could be troubling. I'd still expect him to win a split, but it could be a split, you know?
Yeah. So one more question for you. Not that he's really a prospect, but I'm curious as to what you think of this. What do you think of Rustam Habilov? How do you think he'll react to coming off his first loss?
I expect him to absolutely. I like Adriano Martins a lot. I think he's really underrated, but I expect Khabilov to take his lunch money.
Yep.
I expect he'll come out and he'll look to. I think he'll feel like he has something to prove, and the way he wrestles in close, and just like the way he can chain takedowns and create and win scrambles. Martins is good, but he's one of those fighters that is, like, he's a good boxer. He's a good grappler. He's a good wrestler. These things do not all sync together into one uniform style. He does them all well, and against the right kind of matchup, like against Darren Cruikshank, he was able to just take Cruikshank to school in a heartbeat because he could box him inside, take him down, and sub him out. Mm-hmm. But Habilov, he's not going to take him down. And the moment he tries to get inside, he's much more likely to get thrown on his head.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, I think you're absolutely right that, like this is what I think when I watch Martins, that this is what Gleison Tibau would look like if he decided to focus on his striking instead of his wrestling about a decade ago. Like, He's huge, he's super strong, he's kind of stiff in the way that he throws, mm-hmm. but he's got real power, but he's not super fast, he's not real athletic, there's no real flow to how he goes about his business, and Hobby Lobb is all flow. Hobby Lobb's entire game is all about how all of these pieces come together to be worth more than the sum of their parts, and that's literally the exact opposite of Martin's game. That's really interesting. That's a good point you made.
Because, like, I think Martin, you know, partially it's, like, one of the things we could look at. Like, Khabalov is sort of similar to Darren Cruikshank in, like, a weird sort of style way. Like, that sort of wrestling outside spinning shit kind of thing. But there are major fundamental differences in, like, the actual technical work going on there. And we have not seen Khabalov show any problems with people who could potentially box him up. Like, Cruikshank has a very big problem with inside boxers. Khabalov mm-hmm. does not have that problem. Yeah, that is not an issue.
Yeah, because if you're at that range with Khabalov, he's going to belt you with the right hand and then follow that into the clinch and then toss you on your head, repeatedly, probably. Like, the only way I can see Khabalov getting into trouble is if he really decides that he wants to strike with Martins and just doesn't want to get inside, or for whatever reason can't take Martins down, which I don't really see happening. Martins is a solid wrestler, but Khabalov is one of the very best wrestlers in the division. He's got a whole arsenal of takedowns. Like, he should be able to do the business.
Yeah, he tossed Yancy Medeiros around like it was nothing, and Medeiros is huge. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that that'll be a big problem. So the other prospect I wanted to talk about, and this is a weird one, because I love this because it flies in the face of convention. It has so much to do with the idea of what happens when you watch a fighter develop in the UFC, mm-hmm. is Edson Barboza.
Yeah.
And everybody forgets how young Barboza, like, the Barboza's career is still reasonably young. Like, he's been fighting since 2009 consistently. Mm-hmm. So he's at about 5 years. You know, we're heading into the point where we should really be starting to see things click for him in the next year or two.
Yep.
And yeah, we're not there yet.
Mm-hmm. I was talking about this with Connor on Heavy Hands this week, and we were talking about footwork and rhythm. But one of the things that kind of came up, and I realized this when we were talking about Barboza, is despite being, from a technical perspective, a very good striker, Barboza has never really mastered the idea of changing speeds. Despite the fact that he's a guy who has a ton of Muay Thai experience, that he's got 17 Muay Thai fights, he's been around for 5+ years, he's never really learned to show you one speed and then come back at it, and then come back at another. Everything that he does is either circling at range or he's throwing at you 100%. There's never, if he throws a four-punch combination, it's not like one of those in there is going to be a half beat off and slowed down to disguise the next one. Every single punch is 100%, you know? And for whatever reason, it just has not all come together in that. He doesn't really have a secondary skill set. He's a sprawling brawler. And, you know, you contrast that to a guy like Michael Johnson, who came into the UFC with a fairly underwhelming record and has had his growing pains in there. But Johnson is much more three-dimensional. He can wrestle. He can strike, and he can strike with some nuance to it. Really, really short, kind of very technical footwork. He's always in range. He's going to put volume on you. I think Johnson wins this fight. I think Barboza can still get there, but Barboza has made improvements. His hands are way better than they were when he first got to the UFC. It's clear that the work he's done with Mark Henry and those guys at Frankie Edgar, the whole crew in New Jersey, Ricardo Almeida, like, you know, it's clear that he has made improvements. It's not like he's been stagnant. I just don't know if they're the right improvements. Like, do you look at Edson Barboza and think, you know what, you really need to be more of a combination puncher? Or do you think, like, you've got to be able to do something other than strike at some point?
You know, and that's tough for me because I think there is a way to be consistently good, even to the elite, without ever doing more than striking, weirdly. I think we see it. I mean, we see it with, you know, not with Anthony Pettis, but with Robbie Lawler, certainly. I mean, it's not like Robbie Lawler has an offensive wrestling or grappling game of any sort.
Well, he took, but actually, Robbie went 10 years without taking anybody down. I think he took somebody down in 2004. But then he took down Matt Brown a couple of times. And
oh, that's true.
He also took down Bobby Volker when he fought Bobby Volker.
Which or not, is a weird decision. Not something he needed to do, certainly.
I think it was more of a fuck you takedown. But Robbie does have, he doesn't use him very much, but, okay, actually, wait, let me rephrase this a little bit, because I think, I view the clinch as a second phase, as a wholly separate
thing. That would be, I think that's fair.
Yeah, because Robbie can fight you at range, and he can fight you in the clinch. Barboza is purely an outfighter. Like, if you hit Barboza at range, his plan B cannot be to get into the clinch with you because he's not a great clinch fighter. And he's okay, but he's nothing special.
Yeah.
So not only can he not really wrestle and take you down and work from top position, he can't really fight you on the inside either.
Yeah, that's a legit idea. I don't know how much faith I still have in Michael Johnson. We'll see. I mean, I think the biggest thing I wonder about with him is how much he has, like, the killer instinct. You know, he's been able to knock out a few people in his career, but he's also had fights, like, especially that Melvin Gillard fight, where it was just kind of like, nothing clicked in that fight. And he's had that happen before enough where I do worry that he may not have the consistency of output to win fights at a high level.
See, I'm going to disagree with you, and I'll tell you why. Because I think this is less about Johnson than it is about Melvin, but it plays into this discussion. When Melvin realizes that you can hurt him, Melvin suddenly becomes a very defensively minded fighter, and is very hard to kind of pin down because, like, Melvin is not like the world's greatest defensive fighter, but he is very hard to track down. He's got good movement.
Yeah.
And it's hard to pin in place long enough to really put volume on him. But if you look at like the Joe Lozon fight, Johnson put great volume on him. Johnson put good volume on Gleison Tibau. Tibau is not an easy dude to piece up. Tibau is a pretty defensively sound fighter. Part of the reason why Tibau's lasted this long at a high level is because he's not easy to hit. So I see that. But if it were just Gillard doing that against Johnson and not Gillard doing exactly the same thing in his next fight against Justin Gaethje, when Gaethje was going after Gillard and Gillard was in full on, I'm just trying to make it 15 minutes mode. It's hard to finish him there.
I can see that.
I see what you're saying though, and I don't think you're wrong to be concerned about that.
Yeah, I do wonder going into this fight if Johnson's going to get a little like, I'll stay on the outside and see how my kickboxing is, and you know, like, just kind of work on it and go after you with my style and we'll see what we can make work. And I do wonder if, like, he'll get just kind of stuck there with this idea that, like, I'm not going to really go inside and try to work him over that much.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a possibility, but I can tell you that that's definitely not the game plan. I interviewed Johnson a week ago, and just the number of times that he mentioned his wrestling makes me think that he's going to try and that he's. I don't think he's going to want to be on the outside. I think he's either going to want to be in the pocket, he's going to want to be in the pocket, in the clinch, and wrestling.
That's good. I mean, if I'm in Johnson's camp or a fan of him, then that's obviously exactly, because it's not like, and that's the thing with Barboza, and it's the same thing with Crookshank, really. They're very exciting fighters, but they're are very, like, known fallible quantities. Like, these are guys that have set ways to beat them. And so it's good to hear that Johnson, you know, isn't ignoring that in the way that a lot of fighters are kind of willing to be like, oh, I just do my thing and whatever.
Yeah, I can guarantee you, like, I was pleasantly surprised when I was talking to Johnson. He does have a very technical, he has a technical approach. He's sharp. He understands what he's doing. He gets striking on kind of a, it's one of these things, you know. Johnson is an incredible athlete. He's very fast. He's very strong. He hits really hard. But he really has picked up the technical aspects of the game. He's a big fan of kickboxing. He watches a lot of kickboxing. And he had Nicky Holtzkin.
I saw their training video. That was pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, and if there's a second video that came out after that, and it's like if you can hang with Nicky Holtzkin sparring, you know, you never want to extrapolate too much. But like if you can spar with Nicky Holtzkin, like you can fight Edson Barbosa, and you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah, one would hope that, and that's good prep. Certainly, somebody like Holtzkin would be a good gym prep for somebody like Barbosa. Honestly. Like somebody who's going to be that dynamic at range. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I feel we're out of time, and I feel like we've covered everything we meant to cover. Is there anything else?
No, I think we're good. I mean, I look forward to talking about UFC 184 because we get to talk about Holly Holm next week. That's going to be cool.
It will be. That'll be interesting. That's definitely one of those cards that I need better reasons to be excited for it, so talking about prospects will be one of those ways. There aren't still a ton on there, but there are enough to keep me engaged. Because if you're trying to talk about like great vets on the card, that's... Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny how... go ahead.
We passed over Renault and Andrade a bit.
Renault is physically talented, but she's also 37, so...
Yeah.
Like,
And Andrade, I think, in her fight over Pacheco, has proved that against somebody who's not fully developed as a fighter, like, skill-wise, that she's going to win. Like, she's past the point now where she's kind of, like, scrapping with people. Mm-hmm. She's at the point now where she's taking you on, and if you're not able to compete everywhere with her, she'll beat you, so... I think Renault, I mean, she got a great, like, I'm going to look awesome fight against Dufresne, but I don't know that that's going to carry over to this.
Yeah, I actually just, in general, I like Andrade a lot. She reminds me a lot of John Lineker, but without the weight missing and the and the kind of limited skill sets. She actually has other things that she can do in addition to striking. I love Andrade's game. I think she should piece up Renault fairly easily.
Yeah.
Unless she gets knocked out.
Yeah. I would be surprised if she didn't win. So that's one of those fights that I'm definitely looking forward to it. It should be a good fight because I think Renault will at least engage and, you know, be consistent in there. So that'll make it fun. Anyway, that's a show for us. Way more time than I meant to spend. We talked about way more people than I meant to talk about. That always happens. We get off track all the time. But, you know, thanks for joining me, Pat. You can find Patrick at Patrick_Wyman on Twitter and over at SureDog.com. You can find me at TheZaneSimon over on Bloody Elbow. Remember to give the video a like. If you're watching us on YouTube, that's the button down there that looks like a thumb. And, of course, follow MMA, subscribe to MMANation.com and all that good stuff. And I'll talk to you later, man.